Case number 223538, United States of America versus Brian Higgins. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Melissa Salinas is the supervising attorney to be argued by law students Rachel Harrington and Noah Harrison. The appellant, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I want to thank the court for allowing our law students to argue the case, and I'd like to introduce Rachel Harrington and Noah Harrison. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. We'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Sounds good.
Thank you. We are asking this court to vacate Mr. Higgins' convictions and remand his case for a new trial. The district court made a number of errors in Mr. Higgins' case. If time permits, I would like to first address the district court's denial of Mr. Higgins' motion for expert funds before turning to the denial of trial counsel's second motion to withdraw. Mr. Harrison will briefly address the district court's order of restitution and then argue Mr. Higgins' evidentiary issues. The district court abused its discretion when it declined to authorize funds for a defense fraud examiner, and in doing so, it hamstrung Mr. Higgins' defense. In his motion for expert funds, Mr. Higgins clearly demonstrated the necessity of an expert by satisfying the three-part test this court applied in its published opinion in Roberts. The government produced some 1,300 pages of financial records against Mr. Higgins, covering 4 bank accounts and constituting a significant portion of the evidence supporting the mail fraud charges.
Mr. Higgins hired his own expert at some point, right?
Mr. Higgins retained an expert, Chris Johnson, but that was not for these financial records. Chris Johnson was an insurance expert.
Right. Well, one of the reasons you asked the court to appoint an expert is because you can't afford to retain one, typically.
Well, in this case, Mr. Higgins notified the court that they needed a fraud examiner in order to examine the financial records and make sense of the transactions. Mr. Higgins was an indigent defendant who qualified for the appointment of...
He probably was, but then he also hired an expert, which would suggest, I think that expert did something different, but he hired an expert, which would undercut his argument that he couldn't afford an expert. But they did different things. So I think maybe one point is they were doing different things for the defendant.
They were. The two experts, the expert that was requested did serve a different purpose than Mr. Johnson. But I think what's important here is that Mr. Higgins was an indigent defendant under the CJA who qualified for appointed counsel. And the CJA does provide for the appointment of any expert that is necessary in order for the defendant to present an adequate defense, which is what Mr. Higgins requested here, because without an expert fraud examiner, counsel explained that they could not themselves understand the financial records because they had no accounting background.
Was there some indication? I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Nope. Go ahead, Judge.
Nope. After you.
All right. Well,
I don't want to break the tie.
Yeah.
The complexity of these financial records was not that high, was it? Wasn't the real reason that his counsel was actually asking for an expert was because they were pretty voluminous and she was needing some assistance with getting through all of them? And didn't the, this is going to be a multi-part question, and didn't the court really deal with that by actually appointing another attorney to help her, something that's really, you know, out of the ordinary for what was not a high-level complex fraud case?
Yeah, the appointment of co-counsel was out of the ordinary and was done because the district court acknowledged that this was an extremely difficult case. But the appointment of co-counsel did not obviate the need for an expert in this case. Co-counsel also did not have an accounting background, but not only that...
Well, the government didn't have an expert on financial matters.
The government didn't have an expert, but they did rely on the testimony of FBI fraud examiner Susan Sigler, who testified as to the exact same transactions that Mr. Higgins explained to the court he needed an expert to understand.
Was she anything more than just a summary witness, someone to summarize the financial documents for the court and for everyone who was there?
She did summarize the financial documents, but the important thing here is that an expert in this case was necessary to understand the records because experts not only investigate and help in the development of defenses, but they also help develop cross-examination. And cross-examination of Ms. Sigler in this case would have been critical, well-developed cross-examination of Ms. Sigler in this case would have been critical to Mr. Higgins' defense. Classifying the transactions as simple but voluminous, I think, undercuts what was really going on here because we're talking about bank accounts that were solely held, jointly held, business accounts, transfers of funds between all these accounts over an extended period of time, and money is fungible. So an expert in this case could have assisted Mr. Higgins in explaining alternative alternative explanations for the movement of funds between accounts. If there are no further questions, I'd like to briefly address the denial of the second motion to withdraw. The district court also abused its discretion when it denied trial counsel's motion to withdraw. Mr. Higgins and his counsel informed the court that there had been a total breakdown in communication necessitating withdrawal of counsel. The court below should have granted the motion because the relationship between Mr. Higgins and his counsel had become, in counsel's own words, adversarial. Attorney Paul Laufman.
I thought he also complimented his counsel at some points and said they did a thorough job.
On prompting of the district court, Mr. Higgins did acknowledge that he believed his counsel was competent, but that doesn't mean that the counsel could adequately represent Mr. Higgins in this case. As this court said in its published opinion in Linton v. Perini, the basic trust between counsel and defendant is the cornerstone of the adversary system and effective assistance of counsel.
What was the reason they broke down the relationships? I mean, it seemed like Mr. Higgins was worried about some conspiracy having nothing to do with this case, and his lawyers wouldn't investigate it, and that was part of the reason for the breakdown in relationship.
There was some tension there, but I think it's important to recognize that counsel clearly said in the hearing that it is just as much and perhaps more critically our relationship with him. And that is a quote from Paul Laufman. Attorney Tamara Sack said there is simply no relationship. There is nothing left. There are no meaningful discussions being had. This is a case in which counsel told the court we should not go forward. Our ability to represent Mr. Higgins is fatally flawed.
But do we know that it's fatally flawed for any reason other than counsel, perhaps, not wanting to advance this argument about this Chicago sex conspiracy and how it was some sort of defense? Is there any indication in the record that there are other aspects of the relationship that caused problems other than maybe some doubt that the attorneys had about this defense?
Both Mr. Higgins and counsel explained that it was really the relationship that was at issue. Mr. Higgins evinced a clear understanding of the district court's decision as to those evidentiary issues. And they explained that what was really going on is that they had stopped communicating, which is the critical factor in this case, that third MAC factor. I do see that my time has expired, so if there are no further questions, Mr. Harrison will present the rest of our argument.
Thank you. And you have
minutes
for rebuttal also. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'd like to start my argument today by focusing on the issue of restitution before turning to the District Court's evidentiary issues at trial, particularly the Court's error in admitting a non-probative but highly and unfairly prejudicial audio recording in violation of Rules 404 and 403 of the Rules of Evidence. With regards to restitution, for the reasons explained in our briefs, the Court committed reversible error under this Court's published opinions in Kilpatrick and Saucebe. The clear results to vacate the restitution order and remand for an evidentiary hearing so that restitution may be properly calculated as Mr. Higgins had requested at trial. I'm happy to answer any questions on restitution, but if not, we rest on the arguments in our briefs.
Is the main error that the judge didn't show homework on as to how the number was calculated? Is that the main error you're...
There's two errors. That certainly is an error in the fact that there was a dispute over the method of calculation, and the trial judge failed to adequately explain the error as required by the Supreme Court's decision in Gall. But based on the fact that the trial court also ordered restitution to the exact amount to the cent that had been requested by the government, and that amount had been arrived at the erroneous method of calculation, we can reasonably infer that the that the trial court had imputed the wrong method of calculation. So the error is two-part, both the presumed wrongfulness.
Second, the judge just accepted the number without doing any
without fail
as to what the actual gain and loss.
Yes, correct, Your Honor. Moving on to the issue of prior act evidence, this court or the court below erred by admitting a non-probative but highly unfairly prejudicial audio recording from 2014. And this audio recording concerned offhand comments that Mr. Higgins made to a third party, specifically regarding that third party's business dispute, and was not tied to the same facts underlying the case against Mr. Higgins. The admission of this audio recording provided the jury with an impermissible propensity-based shortcut around their nuanced task of deciding Mr. Higgins' mental state when he filed the 2020 lawsuits. And this court's published opinion in Hazelwood instructs us, which also concerned the admission of audio recordings, instructs us that this is the precise type of propensity-based reasoning that Rule 404 prohibits against, the reasoning that because Mr. Higgins back in 2014 had expressed an idea that in 2020, in response to a completely different set of facts, that he acted in accordance with that idea. And this recording was not admissible under...
Is it the time you think is the... What's the big... Is it the time that's passed? It's not close enough? It's not contemporaneous enough? Or you think the scenarios aren't similar enough? Why? It's the same strategy.
It's the same general strategy in response to different facts. So it is, Your Honor, both time and the lack of similarity between the facts of that third-party business dispute when Mr. Higgins was advising individual B in that recording to the facts that were actually underlying the case against him. But also the temporal remoteness certainly does play a role there. This court's published opinion in Love instructs that there is no absolute maximum or absolute minimum with regard to how old prior act evidence can be in order to show intent.
We've allowed evidence that was more than 6 years old.
Yes, Your Honor, but a lot of the evidence that has been admitted that's more than 6 years old are criminal convictions, concrete actions, and here we don't have convictions, we don't even have actions or conduct, we just have words. And words spoken... in 2014, 6 years prior to when Mr. Higgins actually undertook the actions that are at issue in this case, are not probative of his intent. An offhand comment 6 years prior, specifically with regards to facts in a issue in a case that was not the same as the facts of the case that were against him, are not probative of his intent there.
Well, even if the facts aren't identical or super close to one another, doesn't it matter that he was actually addressing his approach to certain circumstances? And if the circumstances were similar, that he would in fact engage in an approach that is the same, that would be his intent?
Your Honor, that fact can certainly be relevant, but the issue for the court here is whether, when you also consider the lack of factual similarity, whether that evidence is still probative of his intent. And given the fact, or given the stark differences in the facts of his conversation with individual B and the facts of the actual fraud charges against him that allegedly led to his decision to file lawsuits, those facts are sufficiently different.
What case tells us how similar the facts have to be then?
Your Honor, I don't believe that there is a case that specifically would say how similar the facts have to be.
How do we set the parameters?
This court's opinion in LeVictor sets the general guidelines for the test how this court decides whether evidence is admissible under Rule 404B, first whether it's offered for admissible purpose, but then whether that...
I'm not asking you the rule. I'm asking you're saying that these facts are not similar enough for us to say that this is indicative of his intent. So I'm asking you, based on these facts, what would help us to... What would be sufficient to show what is indicative of intent?
What would be, well, if the government had had a recording of him discussing the lawsuits that he actually filed, or if he had had, or if the government...
That would be direct evidence in the case, wouldn't it?
Yes, so certainly that would be evidence.
I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. I see what you're saying, Your Honor. If it had been, if the facts underlying individual B's decision had been specific to and similar to the facts underlying this case, then that would have been sufficient. But here, because the facts were different, the true reasoning of it is that impermissible propensity-based shortcut, where the reasoning is that because Mr. Higgins had expressed an idea, that he acted in accordance with the idea. And that would be the type of propensity-based reasoning that Hazelwood prohibits.
Your briefing indicates that Mr. Higgins has a Sixth Amendment claim here.
Yes.
Is that something you plan on arguing today, or...?
That's not something we plan on affirmatively arguing today, but okay. We certainly do rest on the merits of our brief with regards to that fair cross-section challenge.
Okay. Is there a reason why you're not arguing it today?
Time restrictions, Your Honor. We are confident that is an issue of merits, but given the various time restrictions of the court, we made strategic decisions about what issues to focus on.
I guess... I view it as a very serious allegation that there were problems with the district's jury selection process. It's a pretty serious allegation to say it's racially discriminatory. And, you know, it was not an argument that was developed really in the district court. You gave us some information. It wasn't terribly well fleshed out. You guys aren't arguing it today. Just in the future, that struck me as a very, if true, a very significant argument, because it would affect every case that was tried in Dayton over a three-year period. And I actually looked at the statistics. I spent a lot of time studying them, and they don't, in my mind, they don't support the conclusion that the brief alleged due to some threshold problems about how the juries are selected. So this is just one judge's observation, is that it's a pretty serious argument. So just when you're gonna make that kind of argument, I would, one, have it maybe support a little more, and two, maybe address it during the argument. Or not raise it. Or you could do it on habeas. If you develop actual statistics, you could maybe theoretically bring a habeas claim on that grounds.
Thank you, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, I do see that my time has expired, so I'll reserve the remainder of our time for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Brent Tabachi. I represent the United States in this matter. If I could begin with where the court ended, the fair cross-section claim. The United States submits that claim was not properly preserved and argued before the district court. Looking at the prima facie elements of a fair cross-section claim, Mr. Loftman's monologue during the close of jury selection really didn't establish any of the key elements necessary to make out that fair cross-section claim. It rambled from indicating that perhaps people of certain political persuasions wouldn't want to attend because of COVID. It did mention that two black jurors had not appeared for jury service. Then there was some discussion of just generally that the jury panel was not racially diverse. But Mr. Higgins himself did not identify any specific group, distinct class, or group of individuals that had been excluded, just as a threshold matter. Additionally, Mr. Higgins, through his counsel, eschewed reliance on any type of demographic data, eschewed having any type of information about the actual jury selection process. This really seemed to be a throw-up-your-hands, last-ditch effort to...
Did you look at the data at all?
I did, Your Honor.
Just as I looked at it, it seems like the court, in a broad sense, is sending summons or notices out to potential jurors, 70% of whom they have no idea about the race. So a vast majority of the people who are receiving these, they have no idea what their race is. And then if you look at the number that are returned, only 7% of them are returned by black or African-American individuals. So... which I think is like half of the number of percentage of African Americans in the jury, the division.
Yes, Your Honor.
So there's some reason why, I don't know why, there's some reason why the materials are not being returned at the same rate. But I don't think that has anything to do with COVID. I don't even know where COVID would come into play here in terms of who's receiving them and who's just returning the threshold information to the court.
Well, and I think the court has hit on what, from the government's perspective, is the key issue here, is that there's just no factual record at this point. Mr. Higgins is essentially inviting this court to act ab initio as the fact finder here on a skeletal record.
We do have a motion maybe it's two motions, to supplement the record with various data that Mr. Higgins believes is, you know, germane to this fair cross-section challenge. I think the government has initially opposed that. Do you still oppose?
We do, Your Honor. We still oppose it for a variety of reasons, but most critically, we certainly don't dispute the authenticity of these records. I mean, they're the court's records, but what they mean is really open to debate. And just by way of example, the demographic data itself, the Supreme Court allows census data to be used, but it's also indicated that the court can consider not just census data, but actually the eligible pool of voters. So in the voters and or here driver's license state identifications.
I know you're not familiar with every case in the district, but you're with the U.S. Attorney's Office. Has this argument been made in any other cases, to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge.
I know you don't know every case.
No, you would know some of them. To my knowledge, Your Honor, this has not been raised in the Southern District of Ohio in any of the seats of court. So based on the record that was made below and the absence of a record here, the United States would request that the court deny that particular claim.
I just one quick follow-up. You said that Mr. Higgins did not identify any distinctive group. Did he not identify black veneer?
He indicated, Your Honor, that
people generally.
He indicated that two black jurors had not shown up and speculated that they had not shown up out of fear of COVID, which by itself would have been an external factor independent of the jury selection process itself, which under Duren would foreclose the claim anyway, because it's not actually a part of the court-issued process that created the situation.
And his identification was with respect to just the two who did not appear, but not in terms of a larger group of African-American?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. Turning to the issue of the motion to withdraw, based on the totality of the four factors that the court looks at and whether the court abused its discretion, given the timing of the motion, the length of the inquiry that Judge Rose conducted here, it's clear that there was not a complete breakdown in communication between Mr. Higgins and his counsel. Mr. Higgins himself affirmed that he thought his attorneys were decent. Certainly no one is going to characterize Mr. Higgins as an easy client, and certainly am sympathetic to the position that Mr. Loftman and Ms. Sack were in. But the nature of the breakdown in communication had to do with this issue of the sex predators in Chicago, which Judge Rose in a motion in limine found was irrelevant to the case and couldn't be brought up.
Well, let me just interrupt one second if I could, and then you can continue. I thought that Mr. Loftman said that the ability to represent Mr. Higgins was, quote, unquote, fatally flawed, that the relationship was adversarial, and that there was no relationship. That sounds like a breakdown in communication.
Superficially, it does, Your Honor. However, when Judge Rose actually peeled back the layers of the onion, it became clear that the actual facts didn't bear out Mr. Loftman's claims. For instance, both Mr. Loftman and Ms. Sack confirmed that they were able to meet with Mr. Higgins, that they had identified witnesses, that they had subpoenaed witnesses, that they'd come up with the trial strategy.
Was that prospective, though? I hear what you're saying. That's all very accurate. And based upon the record of what their relationship had been up to that point, that's true. Part of what bothered me about this was that when I read the statements of the lawyers, it sounded like they were saying that we've been able to do all of this up to now, but at this point in time, so going forward, if we have to try this case, there's no relationship. There's no communication. Is that meaningless or?
I don't think it's meaningless, Your Honor, but it needs to be put in context because clearly they were able and ready to go to trial and actually did a very able job at trial. I'm not suggesting that there is some type of harmless error standard here, but the trial and the events of it bear out the fact that they were actually able to communicate with Mr. Higgins. Throughout the trial, they consulted with Mr. Higgins. He actually testified. They were able to put together a very cogent directing redirect of him. So I understand the phraseology that Mr. Loftman and Ms. Sack were using. But the actual circumstances as fleshed out by the judge didn't bear out their own conclusions. They had prepared, they were ready to go to trial, and they were communicating. It's the crux of the argument was essentially, or the crux of the issue was Mr. Higgins' unwillingness to move on from this child predator sex issue in Chicago, which had no bearing on the case. And as this court concluded in both Vasquez and Watson, a defendant essentially can't create a barrier by fixating on one issue, a frivolous issue at that, and then suddenly demand that their attorneys withdraw. Turning to the issue of the denial of funds, the United States would submit that Mr. Higgins got exactly what he asked for, and that namely was co-counsel. If the court looks at both the motion for co-counsel and then the subsequent motion filed for expert funds, they track each other. And in fact, the request for expert funds for the forensic accountant was filed at the prompting of the district court, indicating that if I can't give you CJA counsel, file this other motion and I will give you that. And the record bears that out in looking at the chain of events of the orders that occurred in this case. But I think more basic even is the type of information that's in these bank records. At trial, the government marked about 150 pages of bank records. Most of them, about 80%, reflected zero balances in these accounts. Ms. Sigler, who, as the court correctly noted, was a summary witness, not an expert, and was never noticed as one, testified at trial that there was really no money in these accounts other than the money that came from the mortgage company. And so what we're really talking about is like bank statements that everybody in this courtroom gets at the end of the month where deposit comes in and then money goes out. This is simply a very simple money-crunching exercise that did not require any particular skill or expertise. I think what's equally as problematic about this is Mr. Higgins' own testimony tended to blow a hole in the need for an expert. Mr. Higgins essentially testified that he had paid for the repairs on the house out of a bank account that he didn't have records for. And he indicated that he was simply paying himself back out of those funds. So it's a little unclear to the United States as to what an expert, accounting expert, would have shown in that area. Turning to the issue of the 404B evidence that was admitted, I'd note that the argument being made on appeal is slightly different from Mr. Higgins than it was before the district court. Before the district court, Mr. Higgins exclusively relied on 403, a 403 argument indicating that this was essentially just character evidence. Now it's morphed, which the government would submit is simply reviewed for plain error, given that it's a different argument being made here. And the government submits that the district court properly admitted those audio recordings to show his retaliatory intent. Looking at the lawsuit that he filed, the lawsuit literally tracks almost verbatim the allegations of the indictment against the informants, which is exactly what he indicated was his strategy in 2014, encouraging the third party, who was actually one of the informants, to flip it and reverse it on someone who had accused the informant of bad business practices. This is exactly what he did here, and it's directly probative of his intent. I will close on the issue of restitution. I'd note two things. As one is the district court actually sat through the trial, and NationStar, who was the mortgage company, explained what it was that this money that was going to Mr. Higgins represented. That was the value of the house that had been diminished by the damage. So every dollar that didn't go into the house and the repair equaled a diminution in that value of that house, that property, to NationStar. And the PSR addendum laid out a calculation, which Mr. Higgins didn't dispute, indicating that there had been money put into the house, about $26,000, but the rest of the money was essentially unaccounted for. It's a preponderance of the evidence standard. The district court sat through the trial, heard NationStar's testimony, had the PSR addendum in front of it. So the United States would submit that there was no errors in the calculation of the restitution here.
Well, didn't have the district court have an obligation, though, to articulate, since there was a formal objection made, to articulate what method it was employing in coming to its conclusion on restitution?
Your Honor, it adopted the methodology employed in the PSR addendum.
And so where in the record does it tell us that that's what the district court was doing?
Your Honor, I believe that in the sentencing colloquy, in addressing the objection, the district court specifically adopted the PSR's language and addendum and the calculation in there. So there is a record to review in terms of how the district court arrived at the calculation. This is not a situation in which the restitution calculation is unmoored from any facts or evidence before the district court. There is a record that this court can review. And also, Your Honor, I would submit that that's not the thrust of the argument that was made by Mr. Higgins in his brief. The issue raised in his brief is whether or not the court incorrectly calculated this as a gain as opposed to a loss.
Well, I do have a question for you about that. So let's assume that what you say, that's true. District court adopted the PSR, including the addendum, which talked about the restitution calculation. You say that the loss to the victim is the diminution in the house based upon dollar for dollar what was provided to him by the insurance company, correct?
It is, Your Honor. And
What's the basis for that? I mean, I noticed in the records that the actual depreciation of the house was substantial, you know, presumably based on a whole bunch of other stuff. How can we pinpoint that the specific diminution in value to the house based upon his fraudulent scheme or the things that he did was the exact amount that was paid out to him?
Your Honor, first, restitution only need be a reasonable estimate. It doesn't have to be dollar for dollar pitch perfect. And so what the government elected to do here in urging this calculation was use the most conservative figure or estimate as to restitution. I think the court has hit the nail on the head. There are a lot of factors that went into why the house ultimately sold for $300,000 as opposed to the $1 million that it was originally worth. And so the government recognized attempting to untie that would have been a difficult, if not impossible, task. Here, there was a fair, reasonable estimate that we know, based on the testimony of NationStar, it did not get that value back in the house of the money that was diverted away from the repairs. Unless the court has any other questions, we'd ask you to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Harrington, I think you have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. With my limited time, I would like to address the fair cross-section challenge. Mr. Higgins was the first defendant to stand trial in the Dayton Division since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. The data provided by the district court shows that there was an absolute disparity in this case of 10.12%, which represents a comparative disparity of 77.8%. The statistical likelihood of that happening is less than 1/1,000th of 1%.
Where did you follow my analysis? I mean, I looked at the statistics that you gave us in the motion to supplement, so assuming we're looking at that in the record. Of the forms that were returned to the court, so the court sends out a bunch of notifications. As I said, I think 70% of those, apparently the court has no idea of the race of the individual. So most of those we don't know. The ones it gets back, it's 7% identifies black or African American. So 7%, so is that where the problem is?
Well, the Supreme Court has clearly said that percentage of the population, the percentage of the impacted group in the overall population is a legitimate measure. And here, the population of Americans in the district that are black is roughly 13%.
Only 7% of the total population return the forms to the court. So the court only has that information to draw jurors from.
Right. And this court.
So out of 30 is 7%.
Well, in this case, what's at issue is how many black potential jurors did appear during the period of COVID, because the court clearly said in Duren that what matters is the panels over a period of time. And across the five panels, only seven of some more than, I think, 270 jurors were black.
What's the answer to the government's position that the COVID-19 pandemic, to the extent that we say that, okay, got you, there's going to be fewer African Americans because of the pandemic, and I'm not saying that we accept that, but if we did, isn't that an external factor which kind of shuts down your argument from the outset, that it's not something that is orchestrated by the court or any particular entity?
This court's published opinion in Smith v. Burgess clearly stated that socioeconomic factors that impact how the jury panels are selected can amount to systematic exclusion. And the COVID pandemic did unquestionably disproportionately impact the African-American community in this country. Black Americans were much more likely to be hospitalized, to die, more likely to work in essential or service jobs for which they could not get off during the pandemic. They're more likely to live in multi-generational households, which increases the risk to elderly family members.
True, accepting this all is true, we don't have data that ties that at all to juror appearance. I mean, I've already found some things that sort of cut the population already, but we just have nothing tying this to who showed up for the jury. This just seems totally speculative to me. I would say you've preserved the issue, and if there are statistics developed on this that are really tie this all together, as opposed to there's a problem and there's a potential cause, but doesn't feel like they're really well tied together, that could be maybe part of a habeas petition. Because as I said, I think the issue would sweep well past just this case. I think it would affect every jury trial in Dayton for a 2 or 3 year period, right?
We do agree with that. And if the court were to find it appropriate to send down to the district court for developing that record.
No, I don't. I mean, I know you weren't the lawyer, but we do a lot of things. We don't usually develop the record, and the lawyers at the district court usually do that. So we'll consider that option.
And if I may briefly conclude,
sure.
We do think it's important that the court recognize that as the first defendant to stand trial, Mr. Higgins could not have submitted the post-COVID records to the district court for their consideration in time for his trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Great to hear from both sides, but especially the students, who really appreciate having you in court. And we hope to see you back again. So thank you for taking the matter. The case will be submitted.